Hi, it's Dave. So I've got a special episode today. I want to talk about how and why some people, and a lot of people, most people, in fact, miss out on the biggest and most obvious investing opportunities. And I'm going to focus specifically on Amazon because over the past decade or so, I think Amazon was one of those obvious big winners. Everyone, at least in a lot of developed countries, were putting in tons of money into buying Amazon products. And it became obvious to most people that Amazon was going to be a juggernaut in the internet e-commerce business. However, the biggest criticism and skepticism toward Amazon, especially in the early days, was on its valuation. Everyone was saying Amazon is too highly valued, right? It's not making any money. It's always losing money. It's just always going to be like that. And that prevented a lot of people from investing in what would a really obvious generational company, Amazon. And in this video, I'm going to kind of give what I think is a key that could unlock actually a new way to value companies for a lot of people that could help people actually catch these generational winners. All right, so let's look at Amazon's market cap over the past 10 years. And what you'll see from here is you'll see that even right now, you know, it's between $1.5 and $2 trillion in market cap. But let's go back to when I think there was a great opportunity to do a 10x, right, within 10 years with a generational company. So let's say May 18, 2013, Amazon was at $122 billion, right, just 8 years ago. So you could have easily done a 10x, even a 15x or so. So the biggest critique, though, even back here in these early days of Amazon still, Amazon's valued at $150 billion in September 2014, and people are screaming, all the journalists, financial media is saying Amazon is overvalued, right? It's not making any money. The P over E ratio is too high, et cetera. And this is keeping people out of the stock. So let's take a look at the P over E ratio for Amazon during this time. This is a 10-year chart. If you notice, it's a complete mess, right? You have Amazon at a 3,000 P over E ratio, right, in 2013. And then it dips to minus 3,000 because it's like, you know, negative earnings. And it goes up to 1,300 P over E, right? Even at this spot, right, 500 P over E in 2014. And this is the typical, right, stat that everyone, and especially financial media, is catching on to, saying that, oh, Amazon is overvalued, right, because of its P over E ratio. Even in 2015, it's, yeah, 1,000 P over E ratio. Who's going to buy a stock like that? If you look at the income to shareholders, and this is how P over E, right, the price to earnings ratio is calculated. You take the price of the stock and divide it by, right, its earnings. And if you look at it, Amazon had measly earnings in the early days of this decade. If you look at August 28, 2013, net income to shareholders is about minus $100 million. So you're looking at this and people who don't understand really Amazon and what's really going on are saying, Amazon's losing money. I'm like, how am I gonna spend, right, billions of dollars in terms of market cap, right, on this company if they're losing money? Like, how can I justify its worth? If you look at the market cap of this company right here, Amazon, let's say, is losing money or making, let's say, $100 or $200, $300 million a year max, and they're valued at a market cap of $150 billion, right? It makes no sense if you use kind of the P over E ratio. I think the main point of this right now, my first illustration, is that this is fundamentally flawed. You can't really value a generational high growth company like Amazon using traditional metrics like earnings and P over E. So I want to go ahead and present a different metric, and we're going to look into EBITDA. So EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. It could be used as a measure of a company's financial performance as an alternative to net income. And the proponents of EBITDA argue that it offers a clearer reflection of operations, stripping out expenses that can obscure how the company is really performing. For example, probably the biggest thing is it takes out depreciation because, for example, let's say a company has spent a lot of money on factory and equipment. That is depreciated over a certain number of years, and that's actually added to the cost of goods in the income statement. So it actually lowers, right, net income. And this can actually be something that kind of skews the performance of their quarterly results, especially a high growth company that has high depreciation. So let's look at Amazon through the eyes of EBITDA and see what we can get. So here is a look at EBITDA from Amazon from August, basically, actually from 2011 to 2015 or so, a five-year period. If you look at EBITDA, this actually tells a different story. EBITDA is almost $2 billion in 2011, $1.75 billion. Then it goes up to about $2 billion in 2012. It keeps on escalating, $2.5 billion in 2013, $3 billion later on that year, goes up to almost $4 billion in 2014, and kind of keeps on going up, right, to $4.5 billion. So what we see is a different picture here with Amazon. If we look at EBITDA, it's actually quite stable. They're actually making a decent amount of EBITDA, and it's growing, right? So can we kind of value Amazon off of an EBITDA multiple rather than, right, a price to earnings multiple? And if we look at, this is actually a 10-year chart of their EBITDA. So I zoomed into the 5-year, but if you look at EBITDA, just continue to increase rapidly, $30 billion, $40 billion, $55 billion, you know, most recently. So Amazon's EBITDA producing machine here. So what can we do to value the company? So there is a multiple and it's a ratio of enterprise value over EBITDA. And you basically take the enterprise value, which you negate debt and cash, and you divide that over EBITDA and you get a multiple, right? And so this is a ratio that's interesting because if you look at the first 5 years of Amazon, the EBITDA multiple was actually quite relatively stable between 40 and 50, right? Maybe 35 and 60 actually, about 35 to 60, that was the multiple. And even right now, right, over the past, you know, several years, it's between maybe 25 and 45 or so. So this multiple is something that is actually quite stable in Amazon's valuation history. So if we put this all together, here's what we get. If you actually used a multiple off of their EBITDA, you'll get actually a more accurate representation of market cap. And if you would have used a multiple like EBITDA, Amazon wouldn't have been that pricey because you say, yeah, I'm willing to pay a 40 to 60, right? EV over EBITDA ratio as a multiple. And I think it's a decent price. And you're able to catch on to Amazon early and hold it. And you're able to do that 10x. Right, in Amazon over the decade, because it's an obvious winner and you're not tricked by financial media and reports that, oh, Amazon isn't making any money. Amazon is overvalued. Look at its P/E ratio and all of that nonsense going on there. All right, I wanna go ahead and look at this kind of question here. And I wanna give some caution here because we always wanna look at the other side. So why isn't EBITDA used all the time? Right, and we have to understand that it's to be used with caution. All right, so Charlie Munger famously said that, I think that every time you see the word EBITDA, you should substitute the word bullshit earnings, right? And so, or BS earnings. And Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are skeptical of companies who are using EBITDA, and rightfully so. I want to explain some of the things behind it. So first off, EBITDA is earnings before before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization. But taxes are real, right? These are things that you can't just avoid. If you're making money, you're gonna have to pay taxes. So, you know, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger are like, why are we removing this right from the equation? Next point is that interest expense can be important, especially for highly leveraged companies. There are certain types of businesses that require high amounts of debt, and that interest actually payments are actually part of the business model. Why are we, right, removing that interest expense when it's really important to the business model? Next point is that depreciation amortization expenses might be necessary for survival. So here's Charlie Munger again. He says, there are two kinds of businesses. The first earns 12% and you can take it out at the end of the year. The second earns 12%, but all the excess cash must be reinvested. There's never any cash. It reminds me of the guy who looks at all of his equipment and says, there's all my profit. We all hate that kind of business, right? So here's the gist of it. Charlie Munger is saying, there's a lot of businesses where the depreciation, or let's say you put in like an investment of CapEx to buy a factory, buy equipment, et cetera. A lot of businesses, you need to continue to put in that same amount of CapEx, right, investments, just to stay open, just to survive, right? And so in Charlie Munger's view, he's saying, why are we taking out, right, depreciation amortization, right, with EBITDA? A lot of businesses is actually a key part of their business model. Now, here's where I think EBITDA can be helpful, actually, and it's when you're evaluating like a high-tech business that has scalable efficiencies in using CapEx. And here's what I mean. My next point is this, is that EBITDA can be used, I think, more appropriately with businesses with the following criteria. Number one, businesses that aren't highly leveraged companies or dependent on high leverage or debt, right? So I talked about a lot of companies, let's say they're using a lot of debt and interest payments are a part of their business model. So that's one thing. The second thing is companies that get much more efficient in deploying capital with scale and growth. So what I mean by this is some companies, as they grow with economies of scale and technology advantages, right, with network effects, et cetera, they actually get much more efficient in deploying capital, whereas before they had to deploy a certain amount of capital to reach a certain amount of revenue and profitability. As they scale up, right, that reduces immensely, right? They could scale a huge amount of more revenue and profit without expending, right, the same types of investments, right, in capital. And these are the companies that I think are more appropriate in evaluating, right, using the EBITDA metric. And Amazon is a perfect example, right? In the early days, they're deploying all this capital and they're depreciating it off of, right, their cost of goods. It's hurting their net income. You're not seeing a lot of profit with Amazon. And it's confusing people because people are saying, oh, Amazon is a non-profitable company. It's never going to be profitable, right? But the reality is Amazon is a high-tech company. As they grow with economies of scale, they use more technology, et cetera, they're deploying their capital in much more efficient ways, right? $1 billion that Amazon spends now, they're able to make a lot more money off of that $1 billion now than they did, let's say, 10 years ago. And with that, right, now using the EBITDA type of angle where you can actually kind of reduce the impact of that early depreciation that it has on a company is actually a great, I think, kind of hack. It's not perfect in any means, but it's much, much better, I think, than a P/E ratio. Now, when you apply this and understand this, you can start to apply this to other companies, like, for example, Tesla. Rather than buying into the FUD and the noise of, oh my gosh, look at this company that has whatever, a 1,000 P/E ratio is too expensive or it doesn't make much money. If we analyze it more from the angle of EBITDA, right, taking out a few items to see what is kind of their core, right, efficiency and cash flow potential this company has, then we're able to apply a reasonable multiple on that company to actually come up with a valuation and not get scared away. And thereby, we're free to invest, I think, in what could be the most obvious, right, generational companies out there. It's like obvious in 10 years, right? Certain companies are going to be much, much more dominant. They're going to infiltrate culture, products and services to the extent that everybody knows about them. And I think this is one of the keys that will help us and that can help people not get scared away from such companies. On the flip side, there are companies you should be scared about, right? Because there are problems and holes in their business models, and maybe they're not as strong as they appear. Anyways, I hope this has been helpful. Go ahead, like and subscribe if it has. I'll go ahead, and if you want me to dive into more about this, apply this example of kind of the EBITDA approach to other companies, let's say to Tesla or to, you know, other high growth companies, go ahead, let me know in the comment section below. All my videos can be found as an audio podcast. Just search for Dave Lee on investing in your favorite podcast player. I'm also on Twitter at HeyDave7. All right, we'll see you guys in my next video. Thanks.